Welcome to Washington Today for November 21st, 2022. I'm Gary Starikoff. Thanks a lot for joining us today. Here are some headlines. Authorities in Colorado have charged the man suspected of opening fire at a gay nightclub in Colorado Springs on Saturday with multiple counts of murder and committing hate crimes. And more details are emerging about the attack, which ended when a patron subdued the attacker and pinned him down until police arrived minutes later. Police say the suspect used an AR-15-style semi-automatic weapon in the attack. At least five people were killed and 25 others wounded in the shooting at the Club Q nightclub, according to police. And we're learning the names of four of the shooting victims. They are 28-year-old Daniel Aston, who was a bartender there, 38-year-old Daniel Rump, who was also a bartender, 40-year-old Kelly Loving, who was visiting the club on a weekend trip from her home in Denver, and 35-year-old Ashley Paw, who had gone to the club to see a comedian. Meanwhile, Colorado Governor Jared Polis has ordered flags lowered to half staff on all public buildings until Saturday to honor and remember the victims. Members of one of the nation's largest railroad workers' unions have voted down a tentative contract agreement negotiated by the Biden administration between the unions and rail companies. The move raises the risk of a strike that would shut down the nation's railroads right in the middle of the busy holiday shopping season. Train and engine workers at the Sheet Metal Air, Rail, and Transportation Workers Transportation Division narrowly voted down the deal, the union announced today. The workers are pushing for better pay, more reliable schedules, stronger safety standards, and flexible sick time. Eight of the 12 rail unions have now ratified agreements with the railroads, but if just one fails to do so and chooses to strike, all rail workers would be set to walk out. The UN Climate Change Conference in Egypt ended over the weekend with a landmark agreement that creates an international fund to help poor nations deal and adapt to climate disasters. The issue had been a contentious one for many years. The agreement came in spite of no new international commitments to cut global warming pollution. UN officials say the world is still on track to break the 2015 Paris Agreement goal of keeping global temperatures from rising more than 1.5 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels. But the International Energy Agency says that if the commitments made in Egypt are fully implemented, warming can be limited to 1.7 degrees. U.S. Climate Envoy John Kerry said that is, quote, something we can be proud of, even if we recognize we are just getting started. We begin here in Washington, where both the House and Senate are out this week for the Thanksgiving recess, but with members still talking about issues and getting ready for the leadership change in the House coming in January. And in a virtual event covered by C-SPAN, Washington State Democrat Susan DelBene talked about the importance of privacy and security in technology. She also talked about her party's recent leadership shakeup.
Talk a little bit about how important it is for this generational change to happen now that Democrats will be in the minority. Nancy Pelosi has been Democratic leader throughout your tenure in Congress.
Yes, and long before my tenure in Congress, she is a historic figure and has done an incredible job leading not only our Democratic caucus, but being a leader for our country. This is a big change, but also an important change. We have incredible leaders throughout our caucus, and I think an opportunity for us to see a lot of people participate in ways maybe they haven't before. And I think that's will be healthy for the organization.
Man running the Democratic caucus. We're talking about Hakeem Jeffries, the Democrat from New York, expected to be leading the Democrats in the minority. No person of color has ever led a party caucus in the House or the Senate.
Exactly. I think we have an opportunity to bring the diverse views across our caucus forward. We have a great crop of new leaders, and folks are ready to push back on extremism and make sure that we focus on moving forward, helping move our country forward. So it's a big, big change, an important change, and I think we see a lot of opportunity ahead.
I want to ask you one more question on the caucus, but you supported a change to caucus rules that would allow the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee chair to be selected by the Democratic leader. That role is currently a position that members campaign for. Can you explain your thinking behind that?
Yeah, well, as you probably know, too, this used to be a position that was appointed by the Democratic leader. And I think it's important that everyone is in sync working together, that we have someone working on the campaign side focused on helping folks in tough elections, helping make sure that we are focused on winning the majority. And so we have support from others, Congressman Schneider, Congressman Pocan. I think we want to make sure that the leader has a great partner here. And so we put this amendment forward and it'll be voted on as part of our internal rules.
Is this a role that you might be seeking yourself?
Not if I were seeking, I would be also running because this may not change. So I just think it's the right way for us to move forward, and we have a lot of support for that.
Representative Susan DelBene, Democrat of Washington, speaking with Anna Palmer of Punchbowl News. You can see the entire event at cspan.org. And Republican members are looking forward to taking leadership roles in the House. Representative James Comer of Kentucky, who will chair the powerful House Oversight Committee, talked about his plan to investigate business dealings of President Biden and his son, Hunter.
Well, as I said at the press conference, we're focused squarely on the bank violations and the bank records. The reason we're focused on the bank violations is because the Biden family has an unprecedented 150 bank violations. These are called suspicious activity reports. I have two in hand. Just from the two in hand that I have, I can tell you this is very serious. And that's why we're pursuing an investigation of Joe Biden. Secondly, if you look at the emails and text messages that Hunter sends to various people, he's complaining about having to keep his father up. He says he pays his father's living expenses. Now, let's think about this. Hunter Biden's only source of income were from China and Russia, our adversaries. So he's taking money from China and Russia for influence peddling. There's no other way to put it.
Yeah.
And then he's, according to himself in his text messages and emails, he's then turning around and paying his father's living expenses. That's why we want the bank records. So we're looking at the bank records and the bank violations.
So can you tell me how you got those two SARs?
Yeah, we got them from sources. Now they're on the internet, so we could put as much on there as our counsel would let us. Obviously, there's some names and personal information. You know, what I've been saying about these suspicious activity reports all the time is that when you get one of those bank violations, not only does your account freeze, any account that you've had a transaction with within a certain time period is also frozen. That's why banks don't like to do these suspicious activity reports. Contrary to what the Washington Post fact checker says, they say, well, banks give these out all the time. That is not true. I was a director of a bank for over a decade. The last thing a bank wants to do is issue one of these suspicious activity reports.
Let alone 150.
150,
right.
And you can see how many accounts were flagged for doing spinoff transactions from a Hunter Biden transaction. So the bank violations are very detailed, and they will take us where we want to go with respect to determine whether or not Joe Biden was a financial beneficiary of Hunter's shady business deals and whether or not Joe Biden's compromised because of this money that he was receiving from China and Russia.
Representative James Comer of Kentucky speaking earlier today on Newsmax. The State Department's top official on war crimes says that the U.S. is monitoring allegations of Ukrainian war crimes in their battle against the Russian invasion. The statement comes after Russia's defense ministry said on Friday, cited certain videos circulating on social media that allegedly showed Ukrainian soldiers executing Russian prisoners of war. On a press conference call today, U.S. Ambassador at Large for Global Criminal Justice, Beth Von Schaack, talked about the conflict's possible war crimes and the videos circulated over the weekend.
Has the U.S. determined whether Vladimir Putin himself is culpable for these war crimes? Have you found evidence of crimes against U.S. citizens that could be prosecuted in the U.S., given there have been a number of Americans killed in this conflict? And then there was a video over the weekend that appeared to show Ukrainian soldiers executing Russian ones. Does the U.S. believe this should be investigated, and would this constitute a war crime? Thank you.
Yeah, thanks so much for those questions. I'll take them in order. So there are doctrines under international law that allow for prosecutions to go all the way up the chain of command. Pursuant to this doctrine of superior responsibility, superiors can be held liable for the acts of their subordinates if the superior knew or should have known that their subordinates were committing abuses and the superior failed to take the necessary measures to either prevent them in advance or to appropriately investigate them and prosecute them after the fact. And so that doctrine exists and can be utilized by national courts and the International Criminal Court as necessary. So prosecutors will follow the evidence where it leads. But when we're seeing such systemic acts, including the creation of a vast filtration network, it's very hard to imagine how these crimes could be committed without responsibility going all the way up the chain of command. When it comes to U.S. citizens, I was fortunate enough to visit Ukraine on the border with Attorney General Merrick Garland, and he was able to announce the creation of a war crimes accountability team within his Human Rights and Special Prosecutions Unit. This is the unit that's dedicated to prosecuting international crimes under the Federal Penal Code, which allows for prosecutions for war crimes, crimes against humanity, war crimes, crimes of torture, genocide, use of child soldiers, trafficking, terrorism, et cetera. Our war crimes statute is somewhat limited in how it's been formulated, and there are some efforts now afoot on the Hill, I understand, to expand the statute so that it can be more actively utilized or activated in this context. As it currently stands, the war crimes statute can only be used if either the perpetrator or the victim is a U.S. person. So as you mentioned, there have been U.S. citizens who have been killed in Ukraine, and I know that those are being considered by the Department of Justice. I would direct you to them for more specifics, but that would be a situation where we could utilize our war crime statute. We can't in the event that we have a war crime committed by, for example, a Russian soldier against Ukrainian citizens. If that Russian soldier were here in the United States, we would not be able to activate our War Crimes Act against that individual. So there's a rather narrow jurisdiction. We do not have either a statute on crimes against humanity. And so to the extent that some of these atrocities might be characterized as crimes against humanity because they're a widespread or a systematic attack against a civilian population, we're unable to prosecute that in our domestic courts. Now, the Ukrainians can't either. A number of European states can, including our NATO allies, and the International Criminal Court can. So you can imagine a division of labor where, you know, different individuals might be prosecuted before different institutions, depending on what charges are appropriate and the operative legal framework. And then finally, you asked about the videos that emerged this weekend, and we are obviously tracking that quite closely. It's really important to emphasize that the laws of war apply to all parties equally, both the aggressor state and the defender state, and this is in equal measure. But when it comes to the war in Ukraine, that's really where the equivalency ends. When we're looking at the sheer scale of criminality exhibited by Russia's forces, it's enormous compared to the allegations that we have seen against Ukrainian forces. And likewise, we're seeing a really vast difference when it comes to the reaction to such allegations. Russia inevitably responds with propaganda, denial, mis- and disinformation, whereas the Ukrainian authorities have generally acknowledged abuses and have denounced them and have pledged to investigate them. And so we would urge Ukraine to continue to abide by its international obligations in this conflict. And we continue to reiterate the importance that all parties to the conflict must abide by international law or face the consequences.
Ukraine's deputy prime minister has said reportedly he will investigate the Russian claims. Dmytro Lubinets, Ukraine's top human rights official, said the videos appeared to show a, quote, stage capture where Russian forces were not truly surrendering. The ambassador also said that allegations of war crimes by Russian officials were enormous compared to the allegations against Ukrainian troops. Here's more from Ambassador Vanskok.
Yesterday, it surely can't have passed without notice that yesterday was the anniversary of the opening of the Nuremberg trials, which had Soviet, you know, a chief judge or at least judges from the Soviet Union. And they were able to secure convictions for war crimes and other atrocities. That's not going to be the case here, I think you would have to admit. So what do you think are the actual chances of anyone actually facing any kind of accountability for the atrocities that you say that many say are alleged to have happened, simply because the world is so divided now? It's not the same as it was. And then on her second question, which was about the videos, Are they problematic, or are you just holding your fire, waiting to see what happens with the investigation? Thank you.
Yeah, thanks so much, Matt. Indeed, this is definitely a new Nuremberg moment, just as the Allies at the end of the Second World War banded together to advance the imperative of justice and usher in a new era of accountability for what then was the worst imaginable crime. It now falls to all of us to ensure that those responsible for the war crimes and other atrocities that we're seeing in Ukraine are held to account. And you're absolutely right that the Soviets, the then Soviets, played a really important role at Nuremberg in terms of convening and conceptualizing the Nuremberg Tribunal, in seconding staff, judges, prosecutors, et cetera, to those proceedings. And with the current war and with Russia's behavior in previous wars, they've really turned their back on that legacy. There's no question that the issue of custody over the accused is going to be a real challenge to accountability, even in all of the three pathways that I've identified, in Ukrainian courts, before the International Criminal Court, and then in the courts of third states that might be able to exercise jurisdiction on an extraterritorial basis. But what we have seen in prior conflicts is that perpetrators do inevitably travel. They, particularly as time passes, they want to visit family. They have other reasons to leave. They may be defectors. We've seen this in the Syrian context, where a number of cases have been able to proceed in European courts against individuals who were accused of crimes being committed in Syria, including relatively senior members of the Assad regime. And so individuals like Slobodan Milosevic or Augusto Pinochet, I think, never thought they would see the inside of a courtroom, and they did. And it took time, but ultimately they did achieve accountability. Now, that said, if Russian perpetrators remain in Russia and absent any kind of political transformation there, it will be difficult to move forward. But there's still a lot that can be done with these existing pathways, including documenting crimes, preserving the testimony of witnesses and survivors, creating a documentary record. The International Criminal Court, for example, can confirm indictments in absentia. And so even if they don't have custody of an accused, they can put on a measure of evidence which can show the commission of international crimes, and arrest warrants can be issued, and then red notices from Interpol, which would make it very difficult for anyone to travel worldwide because they would be subject to an international arrest warrant. So there's plenty of challenges. I don't want to understate that, but the world has never been more united than it is now around the imperative of ensuring accountability for this terrible breach of international norms that has been occasioned by Russia's war of aggression.
U.S. Ambassador at Large for Global Criminal Justice Beth Von Skock responding to a question from the Associated Press's Matt Lee. You're listening to Washington Today. Welcome back to Washington Today. Here are more of today's headlines. The state of Georgia is appealing a judge's ruling that allows counties to offer early voting this Saturday in the U.S. Senate runoff election between Democratic incumbent Raphael Warnock and challenger Republican Herschel Walker. Senator Warnock's campaign, along with the Georgia Democratic Party and the Democratic Senatorial Campaign Committee, sued the state last week to allow early voting on that day. They were challenging guidance from Republican Secretary of State Brad Raffensperger that said state law doesn't allow voting this Saturday because it's the day after a state holiday. The runoff election is scheduled for Tuesday, December 6th. NASA's Orion spacecraft zipped past the far side of the moon earlier today. The Orion capsule fired its engines for 2.5 minutes. That accelerated its velocity to come within 80 miles of the lunar surface and into what is known as a distant retrograde orbit. The unmanned spacecraft launched early Wednesday morning as part of the Artemis 1 mission. The journey will last more than 20 days. The mission's purpose is as a test run before astronauts board the Artemis 2 mission, which is not expected to take off until at least 2024. Florida Republican Governor Ron DeSantis is closing the gap with former President Donald Trump in an early poll in the 2024 presidential election race in the Republican Party. A new poll published exclusively at thehill.com shows Governor DeSantis with an 11-point improvement in support among Republican voters in a hypothetical 2024 primary. It now stands at 28%. Former President Trump's support dropped 9 points to 46%. You can read more at thehill.com. And former South Carolina governor and former UN ambassador Nikki Haley is also talking about a possible 2024 presidential run. She was one of the speakers at the Republican Jewish Coalition leadership meeting in Las Vegas over the weekend.
A lot of people have asked if I'm going to run for president. Now that the midterms are over, I'll look at it in a serious way, and I'll have more to say soon. If my family and I decide to continue our life of service, we will put 1,000% into it, and we'll finish it. For now, I'll say this. I've won tough primaries and tough general elections. I've been the underdog every single time. When people underestimate me, it's always fun. But I've never lost an election, and I'm not going to start now.
Nikki Haley has long been rumored a 2024 contender, and she's dodged questions about whether former President Trump should run in 2024. And should the former president run and win the GOP nomination and his old job back, he'd be in select company. With more on that, here's the University of Virginia's Miller Center presidential historian, Barbara Perry.
In The Hill, a column by you is Donald Trump, the next Grover Cleveland, Teddy Roosevelt, or Millard Fillmore in the wake of his announcement for 2024. Explain what those three former presidents have in common.
Right. Well, I actually got this idea the first time in November of 2020, thinking that if it seemed to be going as expected after the vote came in and that it looked like Joe Biden was going to be the winner, what would Donald Trump do? And it just occurred to me that he seemed like he would be the sort of president who would want to run again. So I went back and remembered that Grover Cleveland was one of the presidents to do this and our only president to have actually been successful in doing it. So we've had seven presidents, starting with Martin Van Buren, and coming up to Trump. And the two most famous, I think, in that lot are Grover Cleveland, who was successful in getting two non-consecutive terms. And then the other most famous, I would say, is Teddy Roosevelt, who had served out the term as vice president succeeding to the presidency after the assassination of the president William McKinley in 1901. Then Teddy Roosevelt ran in his own right in 04. And then stepped aside, though he could have run again, but he stepped aside for his protege, William Howard Taft. And he won the presidency, but then there was a split between the two of them, and Teddy Roosevelt became more progressive, and he founded a third party when the Republicans wouldn't nominate him. But all he did was end up splitting the Republican base and handed the presidency in the 1912 election to Democrat Woodrow Wilson, who went on to serve for two terms.
The number you said was seven one-term presidents?
Yes, seven one-term presidents tossed their hats into the ring to try to get a non-consecutive second term.
So what was it about Grover Cleveland's run that was successful?
Well, as a matter of fact, so if you look at the calendar, he ran in 1884, 1888, and 1892. And in each of those, including his losing attempt after his first term to serve two consecutive terms, he won the popular vote three elections running. And he was actually a pretty popular president. We didn't, of course, have polls in those days, but he was quite an honest president who didn't believe in the spoil system and patronage. And but there were issues related particularly to the gold standard. I just noticed the other night and around many holidays, network show The Wizard of Oz, and most people know that it's a political allegory. The Yellow Brick Road is about the controversies over whether the gold standard should back our currency or whether silver should. And Grover Cleveland was very much in favor of the gold standard, but there were some in the party who favored silver. And so that sort of split the party, and it allowed Benjamin Harrison, the Republican, to win the electoral vote. And let me see, I've got it right here. He won 233 electoral votes to 168 for Cleveland, denying Cleveland then his second consecutive term.
You mentioned the term split the party there when a former president has tried to regain office. Sometimes they split their own party. Explain the history.
Well, they do. And again, I think this was a little bit of a case of this happening, but it certainly does happen often when a president tries for a non-consecutive second term, because typically he will have been denied, unlike Cleveland, he'll be denied his original party's nomination, and then he'll split off from his original party and go to a new party. So, for example, in the case of Van Buren, there that controversy leading up to his what would have been a second run and for a non-consecutive term is oftentimes this a terribly jolting issue for the country. In that case, it was slavery. So a new party developed called the Free Soil Party that was an attempt to ban the spread of slavery into new states. That party ended up being folded into the new Republican Party as it was developed in the 1850s. But often, again, that will happen. First of all, there's some kind of really, really destructive issue that's happening that is already splitting voters and splitting parties. And second, if it splits one of the two major parties at the time, it usually allows the other candidate from a party that's rather united to waltz into the White House.
Do you think we're at a point in this day and age that one of the two major parties could see a major split?
Yes, I do. I thought, for example, at one point in 2016, it might be the case, and maybe even in 2020, that Bernie Sanders and that really progressive wing of the Democratic Party might try to split off and run a third party candidacy. And sometimes it's not even a really major movement, but all you need is somebody like Ralph Nader, who gets enough votes to serve as a spoiler, as he did in 2000 for Al Gore. If but for Ralph Nader siphoning off about 300 to 500 votes in Florida, Al Gore would have won Florida and would have won the Electoral College and defeated George W. Bush. So it doesn't even take a major third party. But I could see that happening. We could see it in the Democratic side, and we could see it. Let's just play out a thought experiment. What if Donald Trump does not win the Republican nomination for 2024, but wants to run, and so he forms a MAGA party? That would probably split the Republican vote and some independents, probably siphoning off enough to allow the Democratic nominee to win in 2024.
That is Barbara Perry, presidential historian at the University of Virginia's Miller Center. You can find the entire conversation at cspan.org/Washington Journal. Finally today, with the White House band welcoming guests to the sounds of Lynyrd Skynyrd's Freebird, President Biden discharged an important and time-honored presidential duty today, the annual Thanksgiving turkey pardon.
And a special thanks to members of my staff for their and their young children who are here today as well. Matter of fact, if you look, you see that dog up in the balcony there, that German Shepherd? That's my dog, Commander. I was worried if he came down here with all of you, he'd just do nothing but kiss you and lick you. But he may go after the turkeys, so I kept him up there. But we're joined by another group of kids, as I said, from students from Brooklyn Middle School. The reason they're here in Washington, the reason they're joining us today is, you know, they were invited a couple years ago to come, but because of COVID, we couldn't have it. So I'm glad you guys came this year. Thank you very, very much for coming. And we're also joined by students from the 4-H programs of Virginia and Maryland and the folks from the National Future Farmers of America. I want to thank them for being here as well. But before I gobble up too much time, I didn't mean to get started, man. Don't start on it. And by the way, that's my grandson, Bo, up there, and my granddaughter. Don't let him jump. At any rate, you know, we got to get on with this. First of all, the votes are in. They've been counted and verified. There's no ballot stuffing. There's no foul play. The only red wave this season is going to be a German Shepherd Commander knocks over the cranberry sauce on our table. That will cause... They are big turkeys, aren't they? My fellow Americans, please welcome the 2022 National Thanksgiving Turkeys Chocolate and Chip. I tell you what, man. They can go wherever they want. Of course, chocolate is my favorite. Chocolate is my favorite ice cream. We could have named them chips and science. But anyway, it would have been good names as well. But chocolate chip weighs 46 pounds, and I'm told he loves catching sun on the Outer Banks. And Chip weighs 47, and he loves barbecue and basketball, I'm told. After receiving their presidential pardons today, Chocolate and Chip are going to head to one of the nation's great basketball schools and research universities, North Carolina State. Now, when we told them they were joining the Wolf Pack, they got a little scared. But then we explained it was just a mascot for the school, has one of the nation's best poultry science departments in the country. And now, based on their temperament and commitment to being productive members of society, I hereby pardon. I hereby pardon Chocolate and Chip.
Which one's Chocolate? Who's Chip?
This is Chocolate.
This Chocolate, you're pardoned, and so are you, Chip. Chip says, I know, I don't even have to be told.
Honey, why don't we put him on the table?
Can we do that? You can do that. Honey, that's a big bird, man. We have more chickens than anybody in the nation in Delaware, but we don't have turkeys. Look at this. God love you. Now, this is Chocolate, right? Chocolate, you are pardoned. You are pardoned. He said, you had to tell me that? Yeah. Yeah, you are. Yeah. I'm serious. He said, I don't know, man. You didn't have to pardon me. I knew I was pardoned.
Chocolate and Chip were raised by National Turkey Federation Chairman Ronnie Parker near Monroe, North Carolina. They ruffled a lot of feathers when they arrived here in Washington, D.C. over the weekend, where they gobbled up an opportunity to stay at the Willard Hotel, which is very nearby the White House, and trotted around a Sunday press conference at the hotel. That was earlier today at the White House. Now, following today's festivities, the Bidens are heading to Marine Corps Air Station Cherry Point in North Carolina for a Friendsgiving dinner with service members and military families. That's part of First Lady Dr. Jill Biden's Joining Forces initiative. The Biden family will then spend the Thanksgiving holiday in Nantucket, Massachusetts. You can see the entire event at cspan.org. That's also where you can find this program as a podcast. You can also find it on our C-SPAN Now mobile app or wherever you listen to podcasts. And if you'd like more on the stories that are shaping Washington, you can subscribe to C-SPAN's evening newsletter, word for word. Just go to cspan.org/connect to subscribe. I'm Gary Sterkoff. Thanks a lot for listening today to Washington Today.